Hello, and welcome back to Fractal Friends, the podcast where we explore our self-similarity across our diversity. Sorry it's been so long. I was traveling. In fact, I was in Cuba, and while I was there, I was able to meet some amazing artists, some social change makers, and I was also able to record some really cool conversations for the podcast, which I'll be sharing with you later. But for now, I'm going to make up for the long absence with a really excellent show. Today's guest is Barbara Bash. She is an artist, a calligrapher, and she's a teacher of communication practices. She's also a longtime student of Buddhism, and she's one of my meditation teachers. In this conversation, we keep coming back to an idea that cuts across both art and spiritual practice. The idea of finding the courage to meet the world where it's at. And the surprise is that when we look at the world with open eyes, when we really just open up, we actually find ourselves. And we find that this dance between light and shadow, between what we want and what we don't want, it cuts across nature, ourselves, and the universe as a whole. Anyways, I started the conversation by referencing a little drawing from Barbara's book called True Nature, and I also talk about her blog of the same name. First, I'll just say that it's a really amazing book. The full name of the book is True Nature, an illustrated journal of four seasons in solitude. It documents her experience with nature while on silent solo retreats in upstate New York, and it's a beautiful book, and I highly recommend it. But I also want to point out that I've pointed out the drawings and the paintings that I reference on the Fractal Friends website. So if you want to see what we're talking about, you can go over to fractalfriends.us. And there you can see the pictures that we're talking about. That'll give you a little context for our conversation. Also, while you're there, you should sign up for the newsletter. You can do that on the right, or if you're using a mobile device, you just scroll all the way down to the bottom. That way, you can keep up with the podcast and my blog, which is on a different website. And I'll just give you a taste that next time I'm going to be bringing you a conversation from Cuba that I recorded with an amazing documentary filmmaker. And also, I'll be introducing a series of bonus episodes. And I guess introducing the Spanish version of Fractal Friends, Los Amigos Fractales. And I'll probably be trying to include transcripts of those in English. So if you don't speak Spanish, you can read what we talk about. I'm totally looking forward to that. I also have some other great guests lined up for the next couple months. So please sign up for the newsletter, and of course, if you're listening to this in like Stitcher or iTunes, your feedback or your comments would be totally appreciated. Anyways, in the meantime, I really hope that you enjoy this conversation with Barbara Bash. Barbara, thank you so much for being on Fractal Friends here. I really just thank you for taking the time.
You're quite welcome. I'm glad to be here.
As we sort of talked about before, one of the ideas of Fractal Friends is to start gathering different perspectives of humanity, you know, different ways of seeing the world, and allowing other people to start seeing the world through those eyes. And it's for that reason that you were one of the first people that I thought of as wanting to have on this, because the experience of seeing the world through your eyes has been something that's been very powerful to me. One of my highlights from last year was reading your book, True Nature, and then also looking at your blog, True Nature. Maybe you can explain it a little better, but it's a book of, you know, your experiences of sitting in silence, and you are this beautiful calligrapher and painter, and you capture these moments. And there's this one moment that I just sit with over and over again, where you go down to this lake, this pond, and you say that you got there, and at first it seemed like nothing was happening, but as you were quiet, you started and just let the life sort of happen around you, you started noticing all these little things. And you have this drawing of water beetles fighting over a tiny dead fish. And I just am sitting there thinking, wow, this is something that happened, you know, in New York, you know, who knows how long ago, and this little just totally forgettable moment of life. And you've brought this to my bedroom so I get to read about it when I'm laying in bed before I go to sleep and be there with these little water beetles that no one, they don't even know what's going on, right? And so I guess like kind of the first question I want to ask, because I know that this is something that comes up for you, you know, looking at your blog, like this is kind of part of your experience. Like what is the value of us looking at these tiny little things in life? Like, why do we do that? Why is that so amazing?
Well, first of all, I just want to say, Duncan, that you are the first person in all the people that have read True Nature that have zeroed in on those water beetles and particularly that dead fish. I was like, you kind of reminded me again of this moment there. And I just loved that you particularly picked up on that one. You know, it was, and I'll tell you why. First of all, yeah, a lot of what was happening for me in creating that book and going off by myself four times during the four seasons and combining sitting meditation with taking walks and drawing, you know, illustrated journaling. I often felt like a disturbance in the world, you know, like where humans go, everything disappears or they make a mess or they're a problem, you know. But what I began to see was that when I would go somewhere, my first thought was, there's nothing going on here. Like, boring, what am I going to be doing? And then, because I just had stopped moving, I began to become part of the place just through that stopping movement, which when you're going to draw, that's what you need to do. It's different than just walking through someplace, you know, it's the physics of it. So, yeah, I was sitting there and it just began to open to me. The world began to open and I began to notice the details of things. And a lot of what I draw is zeroing in on those small, the intimacy of it, rather than taking on the whole thing, the whole landscape. I mean, I did that on some pages, but there's something about that close-in scene that it contains all of it, and it's somehow more personal, you know? So the reason why I love it that you focused on that one is because what I realized is that little detail had a little statement about the shadow side of nature.
Right, you know? Yeah.
It wasn't just, isn't that sweet, those little water beetles? It was like, oh God, they're eating a fish.
Yeah, it's this horrible little moment. There's a definitely...
It's like we want to make nature just so kind of wonderful, and then there's this other thing. You know, and it, as I was getting ready to do this podcast with you, I was thinking about a book that I had been looking into creating for children about seashells this past summer. Mm. And I was out on Nantucket and doing my research, and I began to research this totally beautiful moon shell, which is so exquisite. You find it on the beach. It's just like a sensual orb, and you just think, wow, this is really an exquisite piece of nature. And I began to look into who is the snail that actually lives in the moon shell that then, of course, is gone when the moon shell comes up on the beach.
Right.
And I found out that that snail is the biggest, most aggressive carnivore of all the snails.
Oh my
it's
gosh.
Like it's like the mafia of the snail world. It goes along and it drills. It's like a huge bulldozer, and it drills through the shell of a clam and sucks out its innards. And I was just like, this can't be a children's book. I had to tell friends about it. They said, yeah, you should do a book about the underbelly of nature, you know. So I haven't, you know, maybe I will, but I just love it that you picked up on that particular little thing because of the both of it's beautiful and it's not beautiful. And when we study nature, we're studying ourselves. So it's like something about our beauty and what's not beautiful. And it's somehow a bigger sense of beauty comes through, or rightness, yeah. Or yeah.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. You know, it made me think about that. There's that quote from William Blake, to see the world in a grain of sand and heaven in a wildflower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand and eternity in an hour.
Yeah.
And I don't know. There's like we sort of, as we drill in like a moon's tail like into the into the sort of the life a little bit, we like kind of go look at it, we start finding, yeah, that the story of everything is there. There's life and death, and that's also the big cycle, in the same way that our solar system is going to like is born and then dies. I mean, at all these scales, we see these patterns playing out, and you know, we can really, there's a lot of wisdom we can sort of pull out of these tiny little moments in nature, you know?
Yeah.
Because also, like, I mean, not to just belabor the point, but you know, in your blog, I've kind of was looking at your trip to Istanbul, and I love, there's a part where you make the choice not to go into some mosque, and instead you like go paint these little tiles, you know, on the outside of the mosque. And having been in Istanbul, knowing that like these are these amazing, I mean, just infinitely detailed, you know, things that if you tried to capture the whole thing, you never would be able to do it. And so by pulling out this little geometric design and this little tulip painting, you know, you're
getting the whole thing. You actually are.
Right.
It's all in that detail. Yeah. Yeah. You know, I go and I do these drawing classes at the Rubin Museum in New York, wonderful jewel of a museum of Himalayan art. And I say to people, don't try to draw the whole tanka. Just draw the hand, or just draw the little bird, or just draw the little skull on the necklace. And that by entering that detail, you'll enter the whole thing. And it's so much more of a, oh God, it's like you become a naturalist in a whole different way, because you're studying what's close at hand.
Mm-hmm,
It's something about starting there. It gives us some, I keep using that word, intimacy with it. It's a scale that we can be with in a true way.
Right. So I guess it's related, but there's also a theme that comes up. You mentioned this sort of at the end of your book. There's something about letting life show up. And, you know, one of the things that you and I have talked about is the sort of being with the world as it is. Like, this is definitely an important theme. I guess we'd love to hear your thoughts about what it means to let life show up and, you know, to let it be there, and instead of this need to sort of interact with it or do something.
Make something happen. Yeah, that's a great question. A lot of things arise when you ask me that. The first thing I remember hearing from a nature writer years ago, who hung out a lot with Northwest indigenous people or somewhere out in the West, I can't remember which tribe, and he said that an Indian, when they go out to hunt, they would never say, I'm going to go out and shoot a deer today. That would be so arrogant. You just say, I'm going to go out and just kind of see what happens. And that always really struck me, because as an artist, which we all, you know, we all have this capacity to go out and encounter the world. And okay, so I'm doing it with a sketchbook. I go out and I never know if anything's going to show up. You know, I have to go out with that kind of uncertainty. And it's, I think there's often a misunderstanding that the artistic path is Oh God, wouldn't that be great to be an artist and you can just like go out there and get connected and with yourself and everything. But my experience is that I actually have to step through fear each time. And the fear that I can't do it or something. There's some thought there. I have to step through something to get to that alive, connected place. And then, yes, it is good and it's nourishing. And it's a willingness to go out and just see, as you said, what is going to call me. It's like just kind of staying open instead of I'm going to go find something, it's going to find me. You know, I might be walking, but it kind of goes back to that first story of just sitting down somewhere and just that quality of noticing, just continuing to notice. So the process of going out and stepping into that uncertainty brings me each time to some connected place with myself and the world. But I never know how it's going to play out. The artist's path is kind of putting yourself in that uncertain place again and again and again. It's like the good news and the bad news.
I love the idea that you start finding yourself in that. Like, it's something really special. It makes me think, and in Buddhism, there's this idea that like the mind as the mirror for the world, kind of in a way. I'm not sure if I totally, obviously, don't totally understand this, but the idea that the void of the mind is in a way like a mirror. But there's something about the way that that we're the outside and the inside are reflecting each other.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Another way I've heard it said is that I think Chögyam Trungpa spoke about, and he was my Buddhist teacher, Tibetan Buddhist teacher. Everything is a symbol of itself. So everything kind of represents. And again, as soon as I say it, Duncan, I go, I don't really know how to explain this, but I think we're both getting at something, you know. It's a mirror, and I talk a lot about the outer landscape touching the inner landscape and bringing it forth so that inner and outer get starts to move in practices like this. Any contemplative, you know, just being in the world. It doesn't even have to be out in nature. It's just the information we get about ourselves as we're noticing as we move around. And of course, nature, the trees and the greenery, and that's all wonderful, but it's happening everywhere. It's happening just when you get up in the morning and start to move through the day. Everything is giving us information.
Yeah. I want to go back a little bit because you mentioned this blind contouring, the idea of drawing something without looking. You're just following the lines. You're tracing the lines, but you're not looking at the paper that you're drawing on. You're just looking at the thing. If I understand right, part of the idea behind that is to help someone let go. And I remember first doing contour drawing when I was like in elementary school, and I just, it was the worst, right? Because it looks ugly, right? Like I'm like, oh, this is so horrible, right? But now, sort of as a grown up, I can appreciate that there's a way in which, like, kind of what happens is just what happens. This is what it ended up looking like. It also reminds me of a piece of wisdom that someone gave me about art lately is like, you can't mess up. You're creating something that's never existed before. So you can't do it wrong. And
You can't. That's right.
yeah, I guess, like, is that kind of right? Is that part of the value of the blind contour is to help one let go and kind of let go of outcome in a way?
Okay. So, the blind contour is, yeah, that you're blind to the page. And you're just with the thing itself, which start one of the best things to start with is your non-dominant hand, because it's always there, you know, to pose for you, but it could be anything, you know, a leaf. So you're just with it, you're following the edge with your eye, like there, and you're moving around the contours, and your hand is moving on the paper, but you're not looking at the paper. So, impossible to do an accurate drawing this way. There's no way, because you gotta have that ability to check back. But what we're taking a break on by not looking at the paper is the voice that says, you're not really doing so well, and maybe you really don't know how to draw, and who do you think you are? That whole voice can't get activated because it has nothing to refer to. So that voice, that self-critical voice, is what we're letting go of. And then what I find is when that voice, which is a tightening voice, that's its nature, it's to kind of keep things under control or something. I don't know what its intention is, but the line that you then have when you don't have that, how am I doing going on? How am I looking? You know, it breaks the kind of performance mode. The line that you have is beautiful. If you just look at the line itself, it's breathing. It's connected, because you cannot leave the page. If you leave the page, you're just out in outer space, you know. So you're grounded, you're connected. And so what I like people to see in their blind contour drawings is that the line is breathing. That's the line you want. And so the process of drawing is to stay out there as long as you can before checking back, which means staying out with the feeling of not knowing where you are. It's another one of those good news, bad news things. You got to get comfortable with not knowing where you are. And it's like that alertness when you're lost in the woods. You're like really awake, you know, you're trying to get your bearings. Same thing can happen, that sense of, I don't know if I'm getting this. That means you are. You know, so what I really like about blind contour is the way the line relaxes and the accuracy that can be developed. But if you've got an accurate drawing that has a tight line, what's the point? You know, but if you have a really alive line drawing and it looks kind of quirky, that's much more interesting to me. Mm-hmm. You know, and the feeling of it is like, whoa, I just took a journey. It's like I went out there and I felt something, I connected with something, the way a blind person would be open to the world in their senses. And then the whole artistic path, first of all, is accessible to everybody, because anyone can do this. And I always say to kids that this is the artist's mind. You're actually dropping in to the way to be an artist, is to feel the bravery to do one of these blind contours and not know how you're doing, you know, not needing that reassurance and kind of self-reference. So it's a really great exercise to start with.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if it's just too obvious, but it sounds like a nice metaphor for life too.
Yeah. But I still think you're not checking back, you know. It becomes a bigger statement, you know, it really does. Yeah. How am I doing? How's it looking? You know. Yeah.
Right. Because I think Alan Watts talks about this, but there's this idea that like when we're asking someone to perform or dance or do theater, we're like, go and just do something for all these people, but just don't be self-conscious about it, or you're gonna mess it up, you know. And that's, I guess, part of what the flow state or being in the zone is about. Like, people, you have to be able to let go. If you're sitting there conscious of what you're doing, the feedback loop will crush you. And I think that happens, I feel like, in day-to-day life. If we're worried about what's going to happen, or how am I doing this right, I mean, like, that again, that self-referential thing.
Yeah, how is this going to turn out? Yeah, yeah.
And we can't know either.
Yeah, I demonstrate blind contour often for these drawing classes. And boy, is that an experience of like, oh, everybody's watching me, and I am just out here not knowing. It's a great thing to go into and just, you know. And we often laugh afterwards. I mean, there's something delightful about these drawings, you know. Yeah. And every so often they really look like a hand too, or they look like some, not every so often, they have some quality of a hand. So it's like a portal. It's a great exercise. And whenever I feel that I'm tightening up again with drawing, I just go back to doing blind contour. It's like sort of warm-ups for a dancer, you know, just go back to blind contour, and there's a beauty in it. Inherent in it. It's not like this is something else and then we'll get to the beautiful part. Mm-hmm. They're beautiful drawings.
So I guess kind of switching topics a bit, I would love to hear a little bit about your experiences with Chogyam Trungpa and how that was. As I met you, I had to remember where I had heard of him before, and someone had offered me a book of his, the one about spiritual materialism. I forget the, that's not the full name.
Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism.
Through Spiritual Materialism. And, you know, one of the take homes for me from that was something I kind of already had thought of, how like in the West, or at least in the ego mind, there's this need to sort of like compete, you know, like I'm going to be the best meditator. And I remember having recognized that in my own meditation practice and having to like just laugh at it. I'm like, oh, this is a huge barrier to me getting anywhere, is me thinking that I'm getting somewhere, right? Like,
yeah.
And obviously there's a lot to it, but I was wondering if you would be willing to share some of your experiences of working with him, and any stories or moments or memories or lessons, as someone who got to meet him in person.
Yeah. As I look back, it was a powerful kind of karmic, the turning of my life, interacting with his, that happened for a number of us during those years in the 70s and early 80s. He came to this country, he arrived in 1970, and he died in 87. So it was a 17-year arc, and he burned pretty bright. There was a enormous intention that he had to bring these teachings to the West, which had been kind of cast out, you could say, or the whole Tibetan Buddhist world had been forced to travel when the Chinese came in, and he was one of those teachers as a young man who traveled to India and then to England and then to America. He was unique in that he had stepped away from his monastic vows. He did not wear robes. He married an English woman. He taught in English, so, and he taught well in English. Like, he could really, he worked with slang, you know, in a way. So he'd gotten inside the language, you know, what did hung up mean, you know. So all of these things were ways that he made himself accessible. He didn't have the Asian trappings, you could say, and yet the core of it was those deep teachings. I was drawn to him because he was an artist, and I saw that many artists were showing up in Boulder in the 70s. I often say, not a comfortable person for ego to be around. Wasn't like you felt really calmed and reassured by him. There was a sense of exposure that was very compelling. But it was uncomfortable. It was kind of being on a certain hot seat. And, you know, the title of that book was just a really brilliant thing that he did. He putting out that idea that here we were, the 70s in America, and it was a shopping mall for spirituality. And to get these different spiritual teachings. And what was spiritual materialism? So he was really stepping into the most subtle and maybe the strongest bastion of ego is, well, I can be the best spiritual person, you know? When I've maybe divested myself of everything else, that's what you're working with in the end, which you really spoke to. I think I said actually in the acknowledgments at True Nature, to my Buddhist teacher, Chögyam Trungpa, who called me out of hiding and showed me how to live. Mm. So that sense of exposure became a guide for me. And it's something that the teachings that he transmitted, I just keep working with. And it was making your life artistic. How you set up your living space, how you move through the day, how you make a painting, how you have a conversation. So I just feel that as uncomfortable as it was, it penetrated deeply. And I'm still like bringing up the water. It's like a deep well that got dug there. Yeah.
Mm. Thank you for sharing that. As you're sort of tapping into that well, I was curious if you wanted to also maybe speak about the value of practice in your life. That's something that I've been really, in my own sort of meditation practice, just marveling at the idea of practice, right? That we, for me, the practice of sitting down to meditate is almost more valuable than the actual meditation itself sometimes, you know? You just have to come back to it and come back to it and come back to it. Yeah.
Yeah, I said that in the drawing exercise, or to go out to draw in some way, or to step into that drawing space, you have to step through something each time that is something for each of us, some fear, some uncertainty, and you're describing it, that just to sit down on the cushion is as valuable as whatever happens, what unfolds there, you know. It's just, it's that quality of showing up for your life. I'm loving the linkage with drawing, because I said, you know, the thing about drawing is you have to sit still. It you're not moving when you're drawing. So with meditation, sitting practice, you're stopping the outer momentum. You're just sitting simply. And so all that inner activity becomes more visible at that point. And we begin to distinguish that is mind and thoughts and feelings rather than the whole truth of things. It's somehow, is that making sense, or has that been your experience, Duncan, when you sat?
Yeah, I especially, you know, I have recently been doing the open-eyed meditation, and there's something about the, like, you know, like, I'm just remembering, like, I'm just sitting here staring at the floor and, and trying with all my might to you know, focus on my breath and then letting go. Actually, that reminds me, there's this really great thing that I've actually been wanting to remember to tell you. I heard this, I think it was maybe Sharon Salzberg as another meditation teacher, but she said this thing about the practice is in the return. Mm. And I try to remind people of that when they talk. Some people are like, "Whoa, my brain's too full of thoughts to meditate," right? And like, okay. And it's like, well, that's okay. That's normal. That's what brains do. It's the noticing that that's happening, and the returning to letting go of that, that's where the magic is. The thinking and the not thinking, like, those are just states of mind, of states of being.
Right.
But the practice is in the, like, oh, there. And being able to start practicing noticing that, you know.
Coming back. Yeah. I think it's a misconception, an endless misconception about this practice of meditation, that you should be having no thoughts. And that would mean a good meditation. Or that certain people get to the place, well, maybe they do, but not anyone I know. You know? And that there's some sense that I'm not doing it right if I'm continuing to have thoughts. So this is something we come back to over and over again. And I spoke about it, I think, in one of those sessions with you, where we talked about the mountain-like quality of the body, and that the thoughts and feelings are like the weather. And it's the way we appreciate the weather of each day. But what you're saying about the return is so beautiful, because is the quality of return like punitive, like get back here? Or is it just, well, actually, the moment you realize you're thinking, there's no dragging back. You've already returned. It's just happened. It's called natural exertion, you know? And so there's something so gentle there rather than judgmental. So I like it that she's bringing that out, that it's the quality of that return, that it's gentle, it's immediate. And you use the word magic, which is just kind of, it is just kind of amazing, you know, that we came back again, you know.
Here we are once again. Yeah, and all of it, I feel like, you know, brings us towards, and again, this theme about, like, being with the world as it is, right? Like,
and ourselves as we are.
Ourselves as we are, yeah. Yeah, that's really, thanks for that, Claire, that addition
the
there.
World, the world and then here, yeah. And
yeah.
For the outer, yeah.
Right, yeah. Just being able to be at peace with ourselves is
Yeah, and I think that's one thing that I've always loved about the that sense of peace, because certainly the meditation, you know, it's called peaceful abiding. It has all those words about it that we have associations with what peace means. But the deeper sense of peace is having a simple, direct relationship with everything that arises, rather than just a dial tone of experience. You know, it's that things are arising and we notice them. And that's a very stable kind of peace that can include a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, man. So there's this question that's in my mind, and I want to see if I can articulate it, but.
Okay.
Okay. So part of one of the things we've been talking about is, you know, being with art and being with the world and just going and sitting there and sort of letting life show up, right? Sure. And then we're talking about this meditation practice and sitting with ourselves as they are and the things they are. And I also, though, recognize that in the process of doing art, we are making a choice. Like, we're bringing our own interpretation or our own self into it, you know, because when people think about art, you know, there's something about, it's a window not just into life as it is, it's a window into life as it is through the lens of some person, right? You know, yes. So I guess there's the experience of the artist from the inside of the artist, and there's the experience of the art from the outside, you know, so that's kind of a whole nother separate thing, but
right,
but I guess, like, where is the role of interpretation in the process of being with the world as it is? Do you know what I mean? Like, because, yeah. I look at your art and there's a quality to it that's like, that's Barbara's art. And when I go traveling with my sketchbook, it'll be different. And so it's not, I mean, we can look at the same tulip tile at that mosque in Istanbul and it's going to be a little different. So,
yes.
But that's not the same as the ego being there, or is it? I guess, I don't know. There's a both and probably coming up here. But
yeah. Somehow ego does not factor in to this. I don't feel there's any danger around that unless one became arrogant in some way. And we know, we're the ones who know if there's, what was it? Oh God, there was this great line of someone saying they didn't want to collapse into certainty. That was their their hope for themselves, which I just loved. You know, that's the danger, because the interpretation is like, is our uniqueness, is that each of us has a unique mark that we're going to make in the world at each moment through our life. You know, in the Asian way of learning calligraphy, for example, you are copying, and somewhat with the Western too, you are, the doorway is very narrow. It's not like, I'm going to be creative now, I'm going to be unique. You're copying letter forms or characters, you're trying to imitate, and yet what comes through is your uniqueness becomes fuller and richer and deeper. So it's that willingness to kind of drop down and not be special and just see if you can see what it is and kind of make some, you know, be out there lost with the blind contour, like lost in the woods out there, and then where you, in my experience, where you end up is something connecting, unique, and nourishing for yourself. So I just don't feel that it's about dropping that uniqueness. Like that just naturally comes through when your intention is good, you know?
Yeah. That's nice. There's a way in which the intention is also then connected to the practice. It's,
yes.
Yeah, it's how are you showing up?
How are you showing up? Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think I just want to say that around practice, one of the factors that I watch for when I talk to people about meditation practice and in my own relationship to it is, if there's any sense of this is something I should be doing, it's such a slippery one. It just needs to not have any sense of personal demand around it. As even though for thousands of years people have said this is a good thing to do and wise people have said it, it's like you're making your own relationship with how can I stay in connection with myself and the world today? And it's one vehicle that is so simple. And it just needs to be always that kind of fresh choice rather than anybody making you or feeling like you have to do this. Do you know what I'm getting at all?
Yeah, I want to capture that thing you said, the fresh choice, you know, that you get to make that choice again and again.
Yeah.
There's a way in which, you know, each moment we get to sort of start fresh, you know, there's this sort of something about the oscillation of life that each moment ends and then the new one begins. And, you know, it's our choice to, do we always have a chance just to have start fresh? I mean, just anytime that we notice, wherever we are, as soon as we notice, we get to step back and be clear again.
It's beautiful. That's beautiful. And that's, you know, we talk about that within the meditation. It's just like, okay, you sort of, I can't remember what the practice is and what I'm doing. Okay, I'm just going to start over. I'll just start over here, you know? And so what you're saying is that we're doing that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as we get up off the cushion, it's just sort of, there's always that option.
Yeah, and if we find ourselves, you know, being you know, obsessing about some thought or thinking about something again and again and again, you know,
right.
it's not that we're thinking about it for a long time. It's that we're thinking about it over and over and over again. Right. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I feel like that's an important distinction. You know, it doesn't feel like we have a lot of choice sometimes, you know, because our mind can really drag us around. But there is the kind of every each moment being a new moment is always worth remembering. So Barbara, one of the questions that I always trying to ask everyone on this show is, you know, from your unique perspective as Barbara and in this world, what is it that you see from your perspective that you feel like you would invite the world to pay attention to as they're trying to be better people and make a better world?
There are two things that have come up in this moment, and I do kind of like just the freshness of it. Just that ability to let something show up as a response. So one that we've already spoken about, and just to say it again, that ability to return that happens naturally, that we, you know, we may get captured by something and see that there's no way out and we're just caught in something and we have no choice, but eventually, even if a meditation session was the whole time running a story, there is a moment of the bell rings and you're out of that story. So just that keeps happening is true and hopeful and important. And then the other thing that I would say is I have a great belief in getting on the page. And I use this as a metaphor, getting on the page of your life. I use it with having people use really big brushes and get on the page with a big brush and a bucket of ink and, you know, kind of scale the whole thing up. I use it as a way of picking a tiny little tendril of something and just get on the page to draw that. And I use it in terms of our handwriting that I know is less functional. I mean, we don't need it as much these days. So I see it as unique. Everybody's handwriting is unique. Everyone has a handwriting. And it's a portal for self-connection, an embodied way of seeing what's going on. And if we can stay in touch with what's going on with us in the world, then, you know, that inner and outer just stays clear. And we're not creating confusion as we go. So I really love the simple, ordinary pencil on the paper, pen on the paper, feels like it's something about the mark on the cave wall, the touching someone's skin, making a line in the sand. It's a very ancient human act of bringing what's inside out and having it be seen so that others can benefit from one's brave, alive stroke. That carries out there. It's received. It gives life to others.
Right, and something that just can echo forward. Yeah, that's really beautiful. That it's like the meeting point of the internal and the external, right?
Exactly, the meeting point. It's that spot of coming out, down the arm, through the finger in the pen, and going, it's manifesting, you know? Yeah. And it's beneficial for us, and it's beneficial for others, because what the world needs is more connected, alive expressions. It's food.
Yeah, thank you for that. I guess Barbara, finally, if people want to find your blog or your book, where should they look?
Yeah, I think if you just type in Barbara Bash, you're going to get to a website, and you're going to get to, if you say Barbara Bash True Nature, that'll get you to the blog. Actually, the website will take you to the blog too. Or if you type in True Nature, a visual blog, you'll get there. So there are different doorways. Yeah.
Great. Well, again, thank you so much for being here. This has been a real, real joy.
For me too, Duncan.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, fractal friends, I hope that you enjoyed that as much as I did. This conversation left me very inspired to sit down on the meditation cushion, to bust out the paintbrush, and really just to find any way to slow down and watch life show up. So if that's where you are too, I've set aside some beautiful music to accompany you in that process. Here you have Steve Gorn playing the bansuri, which is an Indian bamboo flute. And this song is called Rag Desh. Enjoy.
Thank you.